Hello and welcome to episode number 194 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello!
Hello.
You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S-E-A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S-E-A.
And I feel like for this stretch, while we're reminiscing, we should just call these episode 1994.
They would still be confusing, though, because then it could be episode 94. And people are listening back to these through the archive in order.
Just call it that. Don't officially title it that. Just call it that. Okay.
I'll do that next time.
All right. Great.
Good doc.
Well, that's it.
Thanks for listening. Okay. Traditionally on this podcast, at this point, we're going to crack open a beer to drink on the pod, but we are breaking from tradition tonight because as we record this, it would have been the 98th birthday of our late grandfather, Rinaldo Caracino, who passed away a couple of years ago. And so in tribute to him, in honor to him, every night our grandparents drank Carlo Rossi wine at the table with dinner, and specifically Carlo Rossi Paisano. And I have procured some. I mean, I have it handy. It's not uncommon for me to have it for us to drink here on the podcast in his honor.
Now, this is not the jug of Carlo Rossi that you're used to. This is like giant bottle of Carlo Rossi.
It is. It's oversized bottle. The jug.
You
is
had this already.
I did.
It's half drank, so I guess I hope that you must have.
It wasn't like in your kitchen just a moment ago drinking half of it. Yeah, I mean, the jug is too much for one individual person, I think, for the most part. This is a slightly more manageable size.
From our good friends at Carlo Rossi, here's what they have to say about this one. Paisano table wine. That's it.
did you look on the back?
Paisano table wine.
Okay.
Look, you know what the deal is here.
It's Carlo.
You're tilting Carlo Rossi back in the summer of 2000. When I was asking our mom what we were going to do to celebrate our grandpa's birthday, she was like, this is an okay boomer type situation to give a sense of the boomer generation. I was like, what are we going to do
to commemorate
our grandpa's birthday?
And because we have a tradition on our late father's birthday. We always have maple bars, our late grandmother's peanut butter, since that was one of her favorites. And so we were trying to figure out what to do for our grandfather after he passed away.
And she was like, we've determined that we should either have Zinfandel, which that is not what this is, or hamburgers, because that was his favorite food. And I was just like, have you met this man before? Hamburgers or Zinfandel?
Yeah, those would not be my defining memories of our grandfather.
If anybody says that about me, I mean, I love hamburgers. Don't get me wrong.
That was our first search. That might actually be a reasonable take for you.
If anybody says about me, thankfully you didn't force me to drink this out of the Pelton Cast pint glasses.
You don't need to fill that all the way up.
I think my idea.
Okay.
It's been a day.
Well, yes, it has. A toast to our grandfather. Switching.
That's not very good.
See, the thing is, because of the fact that we drank this all, like, you know, whenever we had dinner with them, once we were of age, this is my definition of what wine should taste like, is Carlo. Switching gears, like everyone else, we're still processing the shocking, sad news of yesterday's helicopter crash in Southern California that took the lives of 9 people, including Kobe Bryant and his daughter Gianna. Our thoughts and condolences go out to all the families who lost their loved ones in this tragic accident. There have been lots of great attempts to process the entirety of Kobe's NBA career in a life too complex to reduce to simple platitudes, and I'd recommend the mini pieces by my ESPN colleagues. For this pod, though, I thought it would be more appropriate to focus on our experiences watching, and in my case, covering Kobe, particularly as an opponent for the Sonics and Blazers, as a rival with the Lakers. You want to start?
Did you want to do this in chronological order or?
Well, you said you had some general thoughts. I did put down some chronological, like I went through and refreshed my memory on some notable Kobe games against those two teams or that I saw.
Well, so I guess there are two things. There's the general thoughts about Kobe, and then there's the more specific him playing against the Sonics, which you have documented a little bit more clearly. But for me, it was, and we've talked about this on this podcast before. Once we get to reminiscing about 2005, we'll get there. was it 2006?
I'm not sure specifically what year. The Kobe 81 game? Yeah, 2006.
2006.
Yes, that's on
there. It was the 2005 Seahawks season, but the playoffs are in 2006.
Correct.
And easily, so far in my life, what I feel like has been the best ever sports day was that Sunday when the Seahawks advanced to the Super Bowl by beating the Carolina Panthers. Then the Sonics win this huge game against the Suns, right, with Ray Allen hitting like a near half-court three.
Not that deep, but
casually.
152-149, the final score of that game, which was much more unusual in 2006 than it would be today.
That was a modern 220-217. And then that night, this is just like a random Sunday night in January in the NBA. Like, this is not the type of thing we should be getting. And it really is like...
Opposite the championship games, where this year they only played two games that entire day, because also MLK Day has become a much bigger NBA holiday than it was back then.
You have this night where it felt like, even though Kobe Bryant was the most famous basketball player in the world at that time, by having League Pass in that moment, and you could just tell that it was so quiet everywhere in the world, it was like Kobe Bryant is having one of the most memorable nights of basketball that has ever happened. And you felt like you were part of like a select group that was seeing it. Because it was fairly late West Coast for a Sunday night game.
Yes.
Not that many people had League Pass at the time. It wasn't a nationally televised game, if I remember correctly. Like,
I don't think so.
The amount of people who actually sat and watched Kobe Bryant score 81 points... Again, this wasn't his last game scoring 60. This was like a devoted few, and it felt like that entire season, like...
Well, it was one of those moments where like everyone kind of started buzzing about it, but there wasn't Twitter yet. Like, maybe there was a proto-Twitter.
Twitter would have been wild that night.
But it didn't really exist. Like, there was a question that came up. I went back and searched through some old tweets to just see what I had said about Kobe over the years, and one of the things that came up was like... there was a day before Twitter existed, or at least was popular, where you could have had it, and I nominated this day.
It was wild, right? Like, it was just like a special night. And that year for Kobe Bryant, like, I'd always been fine with Kobe Bryant before then. I remember when I was a kid tracing, I think there was a Beckett that he was on the cover of, Kobe with the 8 dunking. And this was like his rookie season or his sophomore season. And I was at Valley View, so it was way back, tracing a picture of Kobe like dunking or something. So it's like I liked Kobe Bryant. And then probably I went through the sort of like villainous phase with everybody else. But this moment in 2006, the Kobe against the world Lakers, it was like there's never been an athlete who didn't play in Seattle that I cared more about.
Wow. I was so compelled that day was such an exciting sports day that I wrote like a diary entry about that day and then never did another diary entry the rest of my life.
Wait, you wrote a diary for one day? Wow. Yep.
Which I still have. I've kept it like all the computer changes I've had since 2006. I still have that file.
Wow. You should release the tapes.
I will have to post that.
Yeah. You have to tweet this.
Okay. I definitely have to tweet that. It's very long. It's like 800 words. Oh, so I'll have to put it in.
800 word diary entry?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, a lot happened on that day.
That's actually kind of an incredible fact.
Yeah.
That as a writer, the one time that you ever wrote something just personal or whatever.
Exactly.
It was about Kobe Bryant.
It was also about the Seahawks going to the Super Bowl. Like, that was a big part of it as well. But it was just the entirety of that day. Because you're like, you're riding this high of the Seahawks going to the Super Bowl. And you're like, this can't get any better. And then the Sonics win this amazing, crazy game in Phoenix. And you're like, well, this is it. And I think it says in the diary, like, we went to go play Papa Shot because we were at your house that you shared with the famous cousin Katie.
And we had a college. Papa Shot in our house.
Of course, as one does.
I have to mention that to my coworker who I play Papa Shot with.
And we were just playing in back there, and then someone like flipped on League Pass and was like, oh, hey, Kobe has like 50 points in the third quarter. We probably should start watching this.
And it was incredible. It's the best thing about basketball is that crazy stuff like this can happen on any night, and just like a rainy Sunday,
any given Sunday
in Seattle, like you could have the most memorable sports day of your life.
Not that rainy. I talked about it in the diary. Also, we played basketball that afternoon during the Steelers game. The Steelers Broncos, I think, was the AFC Championship game.
So that was the moment. And I've always kind of liked player, like me against the world players. It's like the Tupac mentality of players who are just like one man with the entire team on their back.
Allen Iverson fits into that, young AI.
When it's like him, except for James Harden. My other take,
you were pretty into it last year after you bet me that James Harden was going to score 70 points in a game.
It is fun when you can sort of feel like that run that Kobe was on, right? Because he'd scored like 60 before then. He was on a run.
He had 62 and three quarters against Dallas.
Yeah, a lot of previous points. Month. And you were like, something is coming with Kobe. And I was thinking that the other thing is the real tribute that Dame Lillard has had to Kobe was playing like Kobe recently and putting this Blazers team on his back and being like, I'm going to one-handedly score all the points for the Blazers.
He averaged over 52 points last week as Player of the Week in the Western Conference.
And I'm excited to see where it goes. Like, I hope that Dame is able to continue this.
Should we do the chronological now?
Yeah.
All right, so Kobe's first game in Seattle, January 26th, 1997, he played 17 minutes in a 104-103 Lakers win, scoring 7 points as an 18-year-old rookie. His only playoff matchup versus the Sonics came the following year in the second round, won by the Lakers 4-1. And he really, and I didn't realize this until I looked it up, he really wasn't a factor at all. He missed two of those games due to the flu and scored just 11 points in the three games he did play. It was mostly about Shaq and rereading some of the accounts. Eddie Jones had a big series back then.
I have like no recollection of that series.
I definitely remember Shaq dominating that series. It was not great.
Around this time period, I remember like a weird memory that I had. Our mom talking to me and being like, our dentist, Dr. McHugh, talking to her and being like, hey, that Kobe Bryant, I think he's really going to be something, whatever. And I remember even as like a sixth grader being like, yeah, no shit. Well, like it'd be like an 03 being like, hey, I think that LeBron James has really got it.
I mean, one of the things I remember, I think this was his rookie season. I think this was a year before the first episode of ESPN, the magazine, was their like next edition. Mm-hmm. And it was... Was A-Rod or Jeter was the baseball player? One of those two.
I think it was Jeter. I remember Jeff Gordon.
I think
was
it was Jeter. No. Cordell Stewart, and I believe Eric Lindros was the fourth.
Oh, Eric Lindros.
Yeah. So
wasn't Jeff Gordon on like the cover of one of those early ones?
Possibly. I don't have specific memories of all of them.
Oh my God.
We skip forward to January 2003 when Kobe tied the then NBA record with 12 three-pointers in a 45-point performance against the Sonics at the Staples Center. And I distinctly remember watching this game in my dorm room at UW, and my thought was, look, hey, if the Sonics are going to be bad, and this was a season that, you know, as many of them did at this point, ended in the lottery, let's be historically bad.
Yeah.
So I was kind of like, Go for the record, Kobe.
Look, those unskilled 7-footers aren't going to draft themselves.
No. Look, Robert Swift's first start was in that Phoenix Sonics game.
Really?
The night of the 81. Wow. He had a double-double.
You diaried about it.
It's in there. Like, I wonder how this will hold up in a few years. And it did not. One of my most memorable games ever that I've attended was later that season, Lakers-Sonics at the Staples Center in March. It was... I did that road trip, and David Locke was filling in on radio that day because Kevin Calabro was doing national radio. So I did stats for him on the Sonics radio broadcast. And I think this is still the case at Staples, but definitely at that point, the radio broadcast was right courtside and like at the scorer's table with Jack Nicholson like 20 feet to your left. It is the best seats I have ever had for a basketball game. And it's the Sonics and the Lakers in the middle of this Kobe run. And the Sonics shut him down. They held Kobe to 22 points on 8 of 29 shooting in a 120-113 win. So that was a really fun day and trip to L.A. And the night before, we went to dinner with Detlef and Jack Sikma, and they just told Sonic stories. That was a pretty awesome weekend.
Man. So Kobe has been involved in situations where you, as a writer for ESPN, have had the best ever seats you've ever had at a basketball game. And then also the only time you've ever diaried.
Correct.
Kobe has been there.
He stood out. Let's see. The following season, Kobe scored 96 points in two games against the Sonics in April 2007, going for 46 and then 50, the only time he scored 50 against the Sonics, and then scored 48 at Key Arena in January 2008, but had just 21 points in 26 minutes in his final Seattle visit.
Did he get ejected in that game? There's one game where he got ejected.
That could be it. I mean, they won by 20, so.
There was some game where Kobe got ejected, and I remember just like, it's funny because I was talking about how much I've loved Kobe Bryant, right? Like after the 05-06 Lakers. And then just seeing him in person and like the visceral reaction you would have to Kobe.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, nobody has ever been more fun to root against than Kobe.
That's what I was kind of thinking, you know, through this whole week is like.
That is correct. Kobe was ejected from that game.
And I remember just like screaming at those seats that we had from your tickets, right? Just like screaming at Kobe Bryant as he's being ejected. And it's like, he just elicits things out of you. Him and Bruce Bowen, too. God, I hated Bruce Bowen.
Yeah, but Bruce Bowen wasn't like constantly scoring. He wasn't.
It was different. Well, it's like I feel like Kobe more so than any other player for that era was the type of player. And like, you know, we saw everybody come through, obviously. Like that's the thing that bums me out about this is like we saw all of these players. Like Luka was playing with like the 2000s team on 2K. And I'm like, I've seen every single one of these players play live. And then you get to the 2010s team, and I was like, I've never seen Steph Curry play live or whatever.
I mean, I still see these players play live.
But Kobe is like the one player from that time period where you're like, you just need to watch Kobe the entire time. Like, no matter where he is, he was so commanding.
Yeah, and especially from a Sonic standpoint, the fact that he made two appearances a year in Seattle and then eventually in Portland.
When there are also so many Kobe stands in the crowd, too.
Yes. And like LeBron, by the time, you know, he was a star by the last Sonic season, but he wasn't yet an MVP and he didn't play the last visit to Seattle that the Cavs made. So we only played here four times.
I think. LeBron definitely felt different. It was like, career. Oh, it's exciting that LeBron is playing. But like Kobe elicits things out of people and the fans come out. It's just like you almost feel like you're in enemy territory, even at home.
I mean, one of the tweets I saw that I was going back was his last game in Portland. Like, I know I'm in the, or maybe it was the previous game. I know I'm in the right place because Kobe just got like lustily booed by about three quarters of the crowd and cheered so much by a quarter of the crowd, which like only he did that. It was the first time that I saw that Kobe in Portland was my birthday in 2009, which was also the first day that I recall going to Loretta's. So
that's
a pretty
huge.
Epic day,
that's
all things
a big deal,
considered.
Yeah.
4 years later, they played Portland on my birthday again. Kobe played all 48 minutes, scored 47 points on 14 of 27
How
shooting
old
in that
was
game.
He?
Well, let's see. This was 7 years ago, so he would have been
34.
34, yeah. The very next game was the game where he ruptured his Achilles.
Damn.
Yeah. So I feel like I saw like the last great Kobe game. Like obviously he had that huge game.
All
in his final
48
game.
Minutes.
He had done that several games in a row because Steve Nash was injured. They didn't have any other point
were
guards.
They what was their record at the time?
It was the team that kind of so that was the Nash Howard Kobe team that kind of backed and didn't quite back into the playoffs, but they were I think the 7 seed that year and then got swept because Kobe was out.
Do you think any of playing all 48 minutes could have contributed to him tearing his Achilles? In all those games,
it didn't help.
Nobody had the term load management had not been invented at the time.
I mean, that was the year I think that the Spurs were fined for resting all their players. It was either that year or the next. So
he was on the cusp. Just come up with it.
But this was probably one of the cautionary examples that led to a little, you know, teams being more conservative with their stars' minutes.
I just can't even believe that like a 34-year-old. How old is LeBron right now? He's basically the same age as me, so I should know. I think he's 35, though.
I think he's 34. I think he was born, or he might be 33.
No. We graduated high school the same year. I thought he was born the same day as
Mrs. Fantasy Genius. He is 35, yeah.
He's born the exact same day as Mrs. Fantasy Genius, right?
I don't know if I'd want to give out that information on the air. Yeah, so he is older now.
And then here's Mrs. Fantasy Genius's social.
I mean, that was a stretch where he had done this. So let's see. His minutes totals. Oh, I've gone one season too far.
I don't think, I guess it is kind of like, I wouldn't be shocked if LeBron played all 48 minutes in a game right now.
It would be pretty surprising if they did that during the regular season. I guess he had rested a little bit during that stretch. That was the only time he played all 48. His minutes totals in that stretch going were 47-37, 47-04, 42-32, 47-20, 41-06, 48. And then
they were getting him 40 seconds of rest here. Yes.
He had already played 44 minutes and 54 seconds.
Was Byron Scott the coach then?
Yes. No, and Byron Scott was not D'Antoni? The coach. That was D'Antoni.
D'Antoni's like, hey, take a 40-second breather.
He had played 44 minutes and 54 seconds before he ruptured his Achilles in the next game. So Kobe played twice in Portland in the final season. He played 21 points in 34 minutes the first meeting. And it was, I think, the next game after that, or it was shortly after. It might have been the very next day that he announced his retirement, which came during the Seahawks Steelers game, one of the most exciting Seahawks games in recent memory.
Oh my God, I remember that night on Sunday night. Kobe announced he was retiring.
I mean, it was right during the middle of the game. Like, I had to start writing about it while I was watching that Seahawks game, which was tough to do. So his farewell tour came to Portland the next month in January 2016, and he had 10 points in 25 minutes in that game. And I remember I stuck around in the locker room for that one to see his final press conference as part of that farewell tour. Shockingly, not as many people as you would think in hindsight. So there's the chronology. I mean, obviously just a lot of memories. Kobe was such, as you've mentioned, such a prominent figure in our lives as NBA fans. And in my case, additionally as a member of the media. And, you know, he enriched our time as fans. Well, shifting gears again, we do have some more positive news to toast to this week, starting with Breanna Stewart, who made her return to the court after last April's Achilles rupture in Monday's 79-64 USA basketball exhibition win over UConn. So definitely good to see her back out there. Moving well, didn't shoot it particularly well in that game, but, you know, the very start of this process, and she's got several months before the start of the storm season to get going. Also wanted to do a toast ahead of Thursday's season finale to The Good Place on NBC, which we can only hope goes out as it began with a reference to Kevin Pelton.
Hopefully it comes back that the whole thing was a dream that Kevin Pelton had.
We still demand answers about whether this is a reference to me or not all these years later.
Answer the question, Michael Schur.
Come on the pod, Michael Schur, you coward. Lastly, a toast to UW softball, ranked number 2 behind Alabama in preseason rankings from D1Softball.com. Yes, we're a softball school. As will be confirmed later in this pod, we are definitely a softball school, and we can't wait until that gets started in a couple weeks here. Okay, now it's time for the feature we introduced last week.
Do we have reader mail before then? Or
do you want to do that first?
Yeah, I feel like we should do that first.
We do have a follow-up to last week's listener email from Chris Wheeler. He said, thanks for covering my PDX versus Seattle question so thoroughly on the pod this week. I'm pretty sure Tristan talked himself in and out of Seattle several times through the conversation, which gives him plausible deniability if we wind up hating it.
That's what I'm about.
Also, that's not possible. I'll report
wind back. Up hating Seattle?
Yeah. I'll report back with what we decide, and made a very generous donation, as we talked about on the pod last week, to the Doug Baldwin Family First Center here in Renton. So appreciate that, Chris, and appreciate your emails.
And hope you don't hate Seattle.
Yeah, definitely not. Okay.
We'll come and visit you in Portland for a weekend if you move there.
Now it's time to remember some years. 1994.
We need theme music for this.
Do we?
Yeah, we need theme music for Let's Remember Some Years.
All right, I'll think about that. I'm not going to do that.
Or an intro thing, like the Don't Burn Yourself.
It's just me saying Let's Remember Some Years.
Is there a Casey Kasem voice?
Let's Remember Some Years. No, that's...
You're gonna have to work on it.
We're gonna workshop that.
Yeah, yeah. So what you do is you play that, and then you just say 1994 after.
So 1994, the year the Sonics won the Pacific Division with 63 games, wins, and then lost in the first round of the playoffs. That wasn't a great memory from 1994. I hated basketball for like so many months after that because of that. I literally did not pick up a basketball the entire
summer. This was the Nugget season?
Yeah.
Wow, 94 was bleak sports-wise.
It was. I told you this earlier that 94 was rough. We were talking about 95, and I was like, yeah, 94 was like the in-between that was not nearly as good as 93 or 95. There was the strike.
Yeah, that's what I was... To me, 94 is all about the baseball strike.
Yeah.
Because when you were a kid, and somehow, when you were a kid in Seattle, I feel like most kids paid attention to the Mariners. Like, they were an exciting team to pay attention to.
Also, it was the summer. There was literally nothing else going on.
Your options were watching Growing Pains or paying attention to the Mariners or the Braves, right?
Like, yes.
So much of our summer was defined by sitting and watching baseball. And then it was just, the strike started in early August?
August 12th, I believe.
And then it was just ripped out of your hands, right? Right before there was about to be the playoffs.
Yeah.
So that, and then the premature exit for the Sonics from the playoffs.
And also, even before that, the Mariners weren't playing at home because you had the ceiling tiles falling from the roof earlier that summer, and then playing, I believe, 20-some-odd games in a row on the road.
1994 before the was strike. Like the bad times before the good times in the Mariners documentary.
It really was.
I mean, it was like the news story with the ceiling tiles falling and you being like, wow, that place was a shithole.
If you watch the 94 documentary or the 95 documentary, I should say, on MLB Network, like that's how they set it up.
Yeah, they're like 1994 sucked.
Okay, so the Mariners' last home game was July 18th versus Baltimore. And then they played exactly 20 games on the road in a row, and unclear when they would have been able to, they wouldn't have been able to play at home because the Seahawks started their season at Husky Stadium that year.
Really?
Due to the
and then the strike happened. Man, that was, we still,
but here's the crazy thing.
Baseball fans after this.
I know. The Mariners, so at one point during this, they dropped to 40-62 after losing at Chicago, and then they won 9 of their last 10 games on the road before the strike.
Wow.
They were surging in the AL West, where they were only 2 games back at 49-63, because that was the first year that they went to the 3-division format.
I didn't realize how bad they were.
Yeah, they seem better than they were retroactively, because they were, you know, around 593 and then made the playoffs.
How were they 40-62 with that roster? Right, because Griffey was healthy the whole time also.
Yes, and was on pace to set the record for home runs.
Oh, my God.
I mean, he had 40 home runs that season. The pitching, I assume, was really awful in 94. Wow. It was Randy Johnson and not a whole lot else. Yes, of their starting pitchers, their ERAs, Randy Johnson 3.19, Chris Bosio 4.32, Dave Fleming 6.46, Greg Hibbard was a major free agent disappointment, 6.69, Roger Salkeld 7.17, Jim Converse 8.69. So, yeah, the pitching was rough, suffice it to say. Also, they were starting a 19-year-old Alex Rodriguez at shortstop.
But that's, I mean, kind of thrilling also.
It was an exciting part of that season. 94
was that brief moment that we had of Alex Rodriguez.
Yeah. I mean, it was incredibly heartbreaking for me because he was called up to replace Rich Amberall during his short-lived stint in the minors.
And so were the Huskies bad also? This was like kind of...
They weren't bad.
But the wheels were starting to fall off the
bus. They were still on probation at this point. That was their second year of probation, so they couldn't play in a bowl game. I think this actually may have been the year they tied to win the Pac-10. No, I guess it wasn't that. They went 7-4 that year.
And couldn't go to a bowl game.
Correct.
Wow, 1994 was bleak.
Yeah.
I remember it as being a good year before you mentioning all of these things. So we have pretty much...
It was also like I started middle school, and middle school compared to elementary school. That was a big bummer.
No comparison. Wow, you started middle school in 1994?
Yeah, I'm very old.
You are old.
Would you like to give up my exact birthday? I mean, I already did.
So. I'm sure people could do the math. If we figure out what day it was a good day is based off of, people could definitely figure out what day the Lakers played in Portland.
That one is not too big.
You're like Kobe Bryant's fire or whatever. You said the year and that the Lakers were playing in Portland.
I didn't say what year I turned. Though. You gotta figure that out for sure. Huskies were ranked most.
You just said how when you started middle school.
I didn't say what. Huskies were ranked most
you
of that season.
Numerous grades.
They did start 5-1 before losing 3 of their last 5 games, including the Apple Cup. Oh, that was also no. I guess that wasn't that year. That was the year the Kenny Wheaton interception.
Wow.
Huskies lost 31-21 at Oregon, a game they were driving for the go-ahead touchdown.
I'm going to need more of this Paisano after hearing about 1994.
I mean, I don't have any strong memories of the Seahawks in 94. They surely played some games.
It was before we were really paying attention to the Seahawks. Like, we'll talk about the Seahawks as we get to the later 90s.
They went 6-10 that season. So that was the last year of the Tom Flores era.
When did they draft Sam Adams, 96?
No, he was drafted in 94. He was drafted the same day the Sonics won the Pacific Division.
Really?
Yeah.
And now his son is going to play for UW. So.
That's correct. Again, we're very old.
Think about it. To me, I feel like it was a great year. I remember that summer. Do you know what came out that summer?
I was getting that is a highlight point, yes.
Regulators.
No, that wasn't what I was going for. I was going for Griffey Baseball came out in 94. Because we talked about it last week because it was based on the 93 season, but it came out in April 94. And guess when we were playing a lot of Griffey Baseball? It's the summer of 94.
And there was a strike.
I think Tecmo Baseball.
It was a clear black night. It was a clear white moon. This was like defining song of our childhood.
For sure. I'm not disputing
We've got
that.
And I think California Love is the next year.
Yes.
And it's like, that's it. That's our childhood. Going into John Roddy's bedroom with him having the Warren G CD, it was like, this is important.
You know,
the seminal record of our lifetimes.
Dan Wiki had a tweet the other week about, like, he makes these jokes about, you know, obscure song artist like Warren G, uh-huh, as opposed to saying, you know, Regulators, uh-huh, Warren G. And he went with something pretty obscure that even I didn't know, because I know some deep cuts off that Warren G, uh-huh, album. I still stand for This DJ.
Oh, This DJ be Warren G is excellent. it also, I felt like this was the year that it was like okay to listen to rock music. We would sit in our grandparents.
Smoking Me Out is what he went with.
Smoking Me Out.
Yeah.
Wow. Sitting in our grandparents' second bedroom or whatever, where they had that little tiny TV.
Correct.
The tiny TV and the organ that didn't really work, but sometimes you could plug it in and it would work. And watching.
But you weren't supposed to play it.
Yeah, you'd get in trouble if you played it.
Yes.
And
it's very much like a sitcom element.
But watching MTV all day and seeing the videos for Basket Case and Black Hole Sun and being like, oh, this music's okay. But I care. Regulators is important, but it's okay to see Basket Case and Black Hole Sun.
Correct.
Being like, I'm a little bit into this, but can't really fully admit it yet because I'm 9 years old.
What about No Rain? Was that too early for that?
Or I Can't Stand the Rain? Oh, Blind Melon.
Yeah.
Thinking. That was like 92.
Okay. Classic video, though. Have you pulled up on, what was it, goldenageofhiphop.com?
Well,
Hip Hop Golden Age.
Yeah, that was 92. There we go. I nailed Blind Melon.
Okay.
So the other thing that I want to mention was, and correct me if I have the year wrong for this, because I think we forgot something in 93.
What's that?
And that was Shaq Diesel.
Oh, yeah.
Just how important Shaq was for our childhoods. I remember one time, we're reminiscing about the year before the year. I'm reminiscing about when we were talking about 93 last week.
Oh, man, those are good times.
Remember when 2020, when we used to sit around and reminisce about 93?
Great.
I remember one time falling asleep we were driving home, or we'd driven home from Michael Roddy's house, and at least I had spent the night there, and fell asleep in the car on the drive home, which is the thing you do when you're a child.
Correct.
And then you all just left me in the car. In the Dodge Dynasty, one of Jan's mini Dodge Dynasties.
I stand by the decision.
And then I remember waking up, and I think you came out to tell me, you were like, Shaq broke another backboard.
Well, I was thinking about that the other day, because it was, I think, the 30th anniversary of Jerome Lane at Pittsburgh with the Send It In Jerome dunk that broke the backboard then. And I was thinking, like, you know, humans, we may be going backwards in a lot of areas, but we've gotten way better at making backboards that you can't break.
Have we, though? Have we? Is this an upgrade? Because breaking backboards was awesome!
It was, but kind of dangerous when a bunch of glass flew everywhere.
Still, it was worth it.
So yeah, I have a distinct memory. Shaq, I don't think he broke the backboard. He just like actually collapsed the entire basket by dunking, is my recollection. Chris Morris shattered the backboard. Yeah, that was a TNT game. I remember watching that one.
But this was like Sunday, like NBA on NBC, right?
I don't remember what day it was. Okay, yeah, we're all familiar with John Tesh. Now the theme song for college basketball on Fox Sports 1.
I don't know if I like it on Fox Sports 1.
It's not made for college.
Isn't the same. You know what I mean? Like when you hear that music, you're like, I'm watching an important game.
Exactly. And because there's only one game each week on television. But you're free time. I mean, there's actually more now.
It better be good because this is the only basketball I'm going to see for the week. But then you watch Pac-12 and it's like, Washington versus Oregon State, 63-57, and every player's going to foul out.
Look, we're going to get to why do we even watch college basketball. That is coming.
Like, this isn't fair to put this song with these games. You know what I mean? Elijah Harding doesn't deserve John Tesh. No. He doesn't deserve Round Ball Rock. But 1994 is the first NBA draft that I remember. Let me see if I have this right. This was the Chris Webber draft, right?
No, 93 was this.
Okay, so this was the year that Shaq was drafted in 92. Yeah. C-Webb was drafted in 93.
Penny was drafted in 93.
That's what I'm going to say. Okay. 1994, what 1994 is about, was Penny Hardaway.
I feel like 95 is more the year of Penny Hardaway.
When is Lil Penny?
Somewhere in there.
I was thinking about if I ever did a TV show and somebody was having like a fever dream with things going over their head passing through, one of them would have to be Lil Penny.
An excellent choice.
The joke one would be Lil Penny.
Lil Penny redirects me to Chris Rock, which I guess makes sense. But I want a specific Lil Penny page. It started in 1994, yes.
I mean, that is like, this is culture. Culture has never been better than Regulate and Lil Penny. That was all we needed. So hanging with Mr. Cooper then. When Coop played for the Warriors, was that 93?
I want to say 93.
Okay.
I think it was, could even have been 92. It could have been Charles Barkley's first year with the
Suns. No. C-Webb was in it.
Okay, then it was definitely
as a rookie on the Warriors.
93.
Yeah.
May have aired in 94.
Oh.
This is great stuff.
Oh, man. 1994. So the other thing that, and we're going to talk about this a lot more in 96. Dream Team Part 2.
I think you may be wrong about this. According to the Wikipedia page, it was the first season of Hanging with Mr. Cooper, which was 92-93.
It's the first season he had the NBA?
Yeah.
Wow.
It went right to it.
They really got into the content. That was a great story arc. But
why isn't Mark Curry more prominent courtside at Warriors games? Like, feels like he should be a famous Warriors fan, doesn't it?
I don't think he's a famous anything.
I mean,
you have to be famous to be a famous Warriors fan.
I might get some angry tweets about this, but is E40 putting out a lot of relevant material in 2020?
God, you're comparing Mark Curry and 40 Water. It is not comparable.
I'm not comparing. I'm just saying. I feel like Mark Curry
is heavy in the Bay.
For sure, he is.
That's like being like a Sir Mix-a-Lot famous. E40 is 100 times more famous than Sir Mix-a-Lot is in Seattle for the city of Oakland.
Fine, that's fair.
This is all wrong.
Let's not forget Mark Curry.
That's okay? Like saying John Curley should be more prominent at Sonics games.
You know, John Curley occasionally goes down to Blazer skips.
Does he really?
Yeah.
Oh, good for him. Wait, I had one more thought. Oh, the Dream Team Part 2. Sean Kemp Dream Team.
Yeah.
Right?
That's true.
Because we had the original Dream Team, but this was our Dream Team. You know what I mean? That was one for them. That was for the old people, the Dream Team.
And you know who hated the 94 Dream Team?
Who was that?
Everyone older than age 18. Probably.
This was our Dream Team. Can you name every single member of Dream Team 2?
No, I definitely
can't. Can you try to name every single member of Dream Team 2? Because we're pulling it up right now.
Okay, so Sean Kemp was on that.
You're
going
to have to wait. It's going to take me a second.
We're going to have to fill time here.
Oh my god.
How many wrong guesses do I get here?
Is this the full roster?
I mean, I could pull this up much more quickly than
I think I've got the full roster here per Wikipedia. Okay.
Sean Kemp was on that team.
Yes.
Isaiah Thomas?
I'm seeing that as a no.
Was he? Maybe he was supposed to be on the team, but then he tore his Achilles. Was Dominique Wilkins on that team?
Dominique was on that team. Maybe a Celtic at the time?
I think a Clipper. I think, or he just signed with the Celtics over that offseason. Larry Johnson?
Absolutely. LJ was on that team.
Shaq? Shaq not on that team?
No, Shaq, of course.
Okay.
Yeah. Really, I'm like not that fond of most of these players in hindsight, looking at it.
Was C-Webb on that team?
Nope.
Too many big men. Latrell Sprewell?
Well, this is bad content. So let me tell you who was on that team. Yeah. We've got Derek Coleman, Joe Dumars, Mayor of Sacramento, Kevin Johnson, an enemy of the city of Seattle somehow. We have LJ Grandmama, as you mentioned. The Rain Man. Dan Marley.
Thunder Dan, okay.
Reggie Miller. Zoe.
I should have gotten Zoe.
Shaq. Mark Price. This is one for us. Steve Smith and Dominique Wilkins, as coached by?
Lenny Wilkins.
Don Nelson.
Lenny Wilkins coached the 96 team.
Do you know anything about basketball?
I can't even keep my...
You're like, well, Larry Nance was on the team for sure.
No, I can't keep my 992.
Pretty sure Anthony Mason was on that one.
I feel like we have to finish, wrap up this segment since we still have teriyaki.
Okay, okay. And well, we'll wrap up the segment as we always do with Let's Remember Some Years by...
Let's Remember Some Songs.
Revisiting from our good friends at hiphopgoldenage.com. The top 40 hip-hop songs of 1994. We'll go through the top five. Number one, I swear this track was released in 1993, but from maybe the greatest rap album ever made, Illmatic, New York State of Mind.
Okay.
Common with I Used to Love Her.
That's an interesting
choice.
Oh my
God, Juicy came out in 1994?
Yes.
Oh man. And this was not number one, literally the greatest rap song that has ever been recorded. Sorry, Nas. Mass Appeal by Gangstar. And... what's coming in at number five?
Regulate hasn't been mentioned.
Out Up! There we go. Okay.
Juicy is a great song, but Regulate's a better song than Juicy, right? This could divide the podcast if we go too far down this road. I'm taking Regulate, though.
Over Juicy? It's literally the greatest song ever recorded. Nobody has ever rapped better than Biggie on that song.
We'll leave that to the listener.
Yeah. Well, we'll see you in 1995.
Oh, I can't wait. Let's get to our search for Seattle's best teriyaki. We did not, sadly, this week get to Ichiro Sushi and Teriyaki, so anticipate that next week. Instead...
Wow, we still have a lot to get to.
Yeah, but we have plenty of time.
A lot of fun. Do we?
There's not that many barbecue restaurants in Seattle, as it turns out.
No. I'm saying a lot to get to on this particular podcast.
Oh, yeah. You know, we do have a lot to get to, yeah.
Like, we have a lot of time.
No, we don't have very much time.
I mean, there is no official time limit on these podcasts, but you know.
I try to keep it under 2 hours. Instead, this week, we went with one of my neighborhood teriyaki joints, Buck's Teriyaki in Boulevard Park, home of the Pelton cast. Had you been to Buck's Teriyaki previously?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't know if it was a thing back when you were living in Boulevard Park.
Ugh. That was me being sad about not living in Boulevard Park anymore.
Yeah. A lot of people are big fans of it. 4.5 stars on Google, I noted. Third Pelton brother Chris Smith is a big Buck's Teriyaki fan.
Hello.
And I got to tell you.
Oh, that's what I meant to say about 1994. Year that I met Chris Smith.
No, that is a big thing about 1994.
Co-host of Talkin' Taco Time to this day. He should have been here to reminisce about 1994 with us.
He should have.
Okay, anyway, Buck's Teriyaki.
I've just never been that big of a fan of it, I got to tell you.
Really?
Yeah. And I went on Saturday night. I called in. What do you think is, when you place a to-go order, what's the timetable you're thinking for teriyaki?
It should be 10 minutes, whether it's actually going to be 2 minutes or whether it's going to be 20 minutes. They should always tell you 10 minutes. That's what teriyaki is about.
I think they should say 10 to 15 minutes, but it should actually be 10 minutes.
Or maybe 7.
I was told 15 to 20 minutes. I went after 15 minutes optimistically, was still there beyond 20 minutes.
Wow, the Bucks was popping.
And it meant I missed part of the second half of the Lakers-Sixers game. I was going to say the Huskies-Colorado game, but I wouldn't say
you had to go shoot nine holes at the Glen Acres golf course in between.
I wouldn't say I was missing it. So that was a little bit of a disappointing experience. But then I ate the teriyaki and I was okay with it because teriyaki is great. What was your takeaway?
Wait, did you have any thoughts about the teriyaki?
Well, do you want me to go through my ratings?
All right, I guess I'll just talk about it a little bit more in general. Yeah. I feel like this had all of the elements of what you're looking for. There's like...
there was teriyaki. There was rice. There was a salad.
No. Just the whole experience. I'm saying you walk in, there's like probably Christian music playing on the radio or whatever. The phone is ringing and nobody's answering it. You're like, I'm home. You're like... this is good. This is where I want to be. I was like, do you need to get that or whatever? And he's like, no. It was a personal call. It was great. This is exactly what you want from teriyaki.
All right, going through my ratings. For chicken.
What did you get? Chicken teriyaki?
I got the chicken and gyoza.
Oh, chicken and gyoza.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is my usual standby.
Okay.
Love a gyoza.
Did they have spicy?
They did, although they don't have a specific spicy in gyoza, and I did not want to like ask about it.
Yeah, that's what you're looking for in this experience. You don't want it to be too complicated.
No, definitely not. So I would give the chicken, I thought, was the standout of this. I gave that an 8.
I mean, the other things are rice and a shitty salad. So like if the
chicken... just in terms of the four chicken, criteria.
If the chicken is the standout...
But that's... the sauce is one of the factors
all right,
here.
All right.
And the sauce, I think, is...
Have you been getting extra sauce, like I told you?
No.
Ask for the extra sauce.
All right.
It's important.
I should be doing that.
Yes. It'll enhance your experience. I ask for extra dressing, extra sauce every time.
I thought the sauce was kind of unmemorable. I gave it a 7.
Okay.
Do you agree with that?
I thought the sauce was pretty good. I mean, I guess it probably was unmemorable. I don't know.
The extras, I gave a 7. There was a lot of rice.
There was a lot of rice.
The salad is fine.
They filled up with the rice, if I recall correctly, the entire main dish, because it should be as served in styrofoam, right? Just destroying the earth. And served the main compartment of...
Way too positive about that aspect of it.
Look, this is what you're looking for in teriyaki. The main compartment was filled with rice with the chicken above it. Then the top two compartments, one had the salad, the other one had the rice, plus more chicken. It was a lot of chicken, too.
It was a healthy amount of chicken. I can't dispute that. Yeah, that was unusual because I'm used to like the extra box having the lettuce, the salad coming as a separate box. Mm-hmm. So that was a little surprising that they put that in there with everything else.
I was trying to think about the Miyako teriyaki, which is near my house. And I think what it is the main compartment is all chicken. And then there's the little salad. And then they use the extra little like compartment in there to put the sauces in. And then they give you the rice in a box on the side.
Interesting. I would think of it as the chicken in the main compartment, the rice in the other two compartments, and then the everything else separately.
Okay. There are many ways to go about this.
Clearly there are.
As long as you have chicken, white rice, and a garbage salad.
So I gave the extras a 7.
Okay.
And then in terms of value, I said 7. A good amount of chicken, a lot of rice as we went over, but the gyoza were very small, much smaller than I remembered. So that was a little bit, and this was also, it was more expensive than the BB's teriyaki.
I feel like the baseline price of teriyaki has definitely gone up quite a bit.
Well, I think that highlights what a good value you're getting at BB's to get the quantity that you're getting there. Look, we've both said our piece on this one.
I think the people on Instagram said their piece also.
They did, although it's interesting. When we first posted it on Is It Story, all the responses were very positive. So, read into that what you will.
I think I would probably agree generally with you. I thought the sauce was good, but it wasn't like right home about. The chicken was pretty excellent. For chicken teriyaki, I just got straight chicken teriyaki. Maybe that's why I had more than you in that separate, because you had the gyoza up there maybe.
No, the gyoza, like I said, came in a separate box.
Oh, okay. So it was a lot of chicken, a lot of rice. The chicken was really good. The dressing for the salad, which I care about because I'm getting extra of it, and I just mix everything all together.
This is something that people have replied to us about. It's not something I've ever done.
That they do also?
Yes, you are not alone in this.
Okay, that's good. Because I don't put the salad in with the chicken and rice, but I put the dressing in with the chicken and rice. And I basically make like a creamy teriyaki sauce. Let me just tell you.
One of the things
you heard the term creamy teriyaki sauce and it sounded good, didn't it?
It did. One of the things I've considered is whether we should try as part of this experiment to make our own teriyaki sauce to our liking.
I'm down for that.
Yeah. I think that might be worth trying.
But ultimately, I thought this was good. I thought the teriyaki, like the whole experience was good. It was exactly adequate for what I'm looking for in a neighborhood teriyaki place. But would I travel for it? Probably not.
No, I don't think so.
And it's not better than my neighborhood teriyaki. So it can't be. I thought it was an altogether great experience. I loved eating it. I love teriyaki, but it wasn't anything that would stand out from good neighborhood teriyaki.
What's interesting is even though this is the more popular and definitely much more frequented, it is not my favorite neighborhood teriyaki place, which was actually a place called Pho Teriyaki Wok.
Okay.
In the grand tradition of just combining two different Asian cuisines.
What it's about. Pho Teriyaki Wok.
I mean, they definitely have Chinese food on the menu at Buck's Teriyaki, which is its own combination, but pho is probably a more dramatic leap, I would say.
Where's the Pho Teriyaki Wok?
That's located by the where the Thriftway was in Boulevard Park.
We're going to have to hit that up.
I suppose we will. So next week, like I said, I will promise we will get to Ichiro Sushi and Teriyaki.
I've been waiting on this Ichiro Sushi and Teriyaki for a long time.
One thing I remembered is there was one time where I wanted to get teriyaki and Buck's was already closed, but Pho Teriyaki Wok was not. But now they seem to have earlier hours, so that apparently has flipped.
Mm.
With our search for Seattle's best teriyaki concluded for the week, it is time to move ahead to the Coach's Corner, sponsored by Pagliacci Pizza, our friends.
Because Pagliacci is a true underdog story. And so are we.
The Sun Devils. What an underdog story. It felt like we probably won on Saturday, right?
Oh, we definitely won.
Controlled the fourth quarter.
I like that you're full in on we, by the way.
I was on the bench.
Any person could walk and sit on the bench.
That's true. But you and the famous cousin Kitty actually would be too awkward and would not tell them to leave. But you were more accepting of my presence on the bench.
So last week, after I described kind of getting bullied a little bit by the team that they played last week, by the Wildcats, you know what I mean? Rivalry game.
Yeah. Territorial Cup.
We had what I would describe as a pretty animated practice. And
an animated practice. I feel like that's not a description I want to hear about a practice involving 7-year-olds.
It was good. We were trying to get the point across that, as Pete Carroll would say, it's all about the ball.
Yes.
Right? You go and get the ball. That's what matters the most. Possession is what matters. Right? And like, we were stopping plays and breaking them down and being like, why are you doing this? Do this instead. You know what I mean? Like, don't clog the lane. If a person is driving to the hoop, three people shouldn't be standing in their way, right? So we're getting to spacing a little bit. just the slightest amount.
Pagliacci's apparently excited about that.
And also talked about, like, if there's a loose ball, go and get the loose ball. Don't just stop because you don't know what's going on. Right? Because that would happen a lot in previous games where it was like, if something happens that was slightly abnormal, everybody on our team would stop and look at us on the bench or pause, and it's just like, play until the whistle. Go and get the ball.
I think it was offline. Was it offline that I told you the story about how in baseball where I just threw the ball to the umpire because I panicked? When I played this rec baseball in high school.
The ball?
No, they like let it go because they weren't supposed to be part of the play at that point. Yeah.
Oh my god.
Good times.
And after this practice, it was like, wow, that was a pretty good practice that we had. I felt like this was really like getting across to the kids. You know what I mean? Like, we did a rebounding drill where we would have two players. And the good thing that you can do, because they don't keep score in these games, is keep score on your own. Because the kids really care about keeping score, mm-hmm. right? And so we'd have teams where it's basically like the left side altogether versus the right side, and 2-on-2 rebounding drills. So we would shoot it and miss. I would try to make the shot, but then miss. be like, okay, whichever side gets to 3 rebounds or whatever, like we'll take a break or whatever. Or they can choose what we do next. And the kids were really getting after it. You know, they were hustling. They were fighting for the ball. Somebody got injured a little bit. It was excellent. Oh, it was just what we were looking for, me and Katie as coaches. You know what I mean? We wanted those kids out there fighting for the ball because, as Pete Carroll would say, it is all about the ball. So
he definitely would not say it like that.
He says it to little Nate Carroll. And I think there's another Carroll child.
Brennan.
Yes.
Brennan.
Brennan Carroll. So, we had this practice, and then we're just like, who knows if it's going to sink in.
Right.
You know what I mean? So Saturday against the hated Bruins and their decade of championships in the 70s.
Look, John Wooden isn't walking through that door.
So pregame, the Bruins are all taking, we're in our layup line, right? Like you should be. And the Bruins are out there taking jumpers. And just let me tell you, the famous Cousin Katie is panicked.
She was
in that
was
moment
quaking in her boots.
She spends a lot of her time coaching panicked, but
also a lot of her time not coaching.
I thought you were saying that she was spending her time not coaching, but no, she spends all of her time panicked. Yes, I understand,
whether she's coaching or not. Probably the right way to live in 2020, in fairness.
So they're out there taking jumpers or whatever pregame. And I was like, maybe they're pretty good. But I was just like, are they making the jumpers?
That was your first question, yes.
Taking jumpers is not that hard.
Well, I can take a jumper.
Anybody can do it. But hitting them is quite a bit harder. Also, no defense. And the amazing thing about it was really them taking jumpers was just emblematic of them being kind of disorganized. And our defense smothered them during the game, right?
I don't know if I'd go that far.
Smothering defense.
They did have one kid that was like actually able to shoot from pretty deep and like knew what he was doing.
It's never a good decision. Even if you're good at shooting for deep when you're 6 or 7 or whatever, it's never a good decision to shoot from
deep. It's never as good as just going for a layup.
Yeah. Like your percentage chances of hitting that shot are not going to be high with defense. And the defense was excellent. Getting the ball was excellent. We were knocking down shots.
I think there was one player in particular. I was like, that kid is really trying to rebound right now.
Yeah. Like, they listened to everything that we said. We were fucking coaching out there. This was a real Bad News Bears type situation.
Okay. I don't know if we've won the championship yet.
Look, as the fans of Utah would say, the win streak starts here. The win streak is now at 1. And
next week is the toughest opponent, right?
The real test awaits us.
Yeah. I'm going to sadly miss this game as I will be in Portland.
Are you really?
Yeah. Blazers host the Jazz on Saturday.
Terry Stotts coaching clinic. Second grade coaching clinic.
Should I ask him for some tips?
I believe on the following weekend, you're going to be out there on your own.
Well, the famous Cousin Katie is still going to be there, right?
No, she's not.
Oh, okay.
You're going to be the coach in 2 weekends on your own.
Great.
Are you ready for this?
No.
I don't think you're ready for this jelly. Timely. but there is a coach who is was at one point the athletic trainer for the Storm, maybe still is.
Not the athletic trainer. I think something in strength and conditioning.
Strength and conditioning coach for the Storm?
Yeah.
And their team last year was quite excellent. So we play them this week, and that'll be the real test of whether we've actually improved or maybe the opponent wasn't quite as good.
Always tough to tell at this point.
You know, our scouting is hit or miss. We're not sending coaches to other teams' practices, but maybe you could be doing that.
I don't think I could or should. Also, I should be watching NBA games probably.
I was very proud of the kids after that game. It left me with a warm glow the entire day.
I feel proud of the kids after every game, but especially so on Saturday, yes.
That's the difference between you and me.
It really is.
And Katie. Katie is really proud of any of the kids, especially her own.
I mean,
it was like everybody was play after the game. I was like, man, everybody played like their best game of the year. And Katie was like, except for my child, who I thought played good.
But had to leave at halftime for a birthday party, which rarely happens to Terry Stotts.
Yeah. Well, just ask him. Be like, hey, I have a coaching performance coming up in a week. What would you do?
What do you do if half
of your team had to leave at halftime for a birthday party?
What do you do if Melo like has to leave for a birthday party at halftime? Oh boy.
Oh man.
Let's get to Seattle sports.
Oh, do we have to?
In 2020, an NHL Seattle update. The Sports Business Daily and Puget Sound Business Journal reported that last week that Amazon is the leader among three finalists for naming rights to the new arena at Seattle Center. Oakview Group's Tim Leiwicki, I have on here Time Leiwicki, which is a funny typo, called the report speculation to the Seattle Times, saying, quote, we're not even close to a decision on naming rights. Notably, Amazon Web Services CEO Andy Jassy is among the investors in the NHL expansion team. And the report also indicated that all three finalists have not done a naming rights deal in the past. So, you know, you're not going to see another T-Mobile arena to go with T-Mobile Park, which makes sense because there's already a T-Mobile arena in Las Vegas.
And because it's obviously going to be Amazon Web Services.
It may not be web services. It may just be Amazon. So we'll see on this one. But I'm feeling pretty good about the bold prediction that Amazon Web Services would be the name.
That's not a bold enough prediction.
You didn't call me on it in December.
The CEO is one of the owners of being the wealthiest and most prominent company in the city of Seattle.
I mean, yeah, there are multiple wealthy, prominent city companies in the city of Seattle. Also, the latest indication, according to the Seattle Times, is that the team name for the NHL Seattle expansion team will be announced in March.
We're not even close.
I mean, that's not that far away. February is a short month, even in a leap year. On the Sounders front, Argentinian club Unión de Santa Fe announced on its Twitter account last week that defender Yaimar Gomez Andrade will join the Sounders. No confirmation is yet on the deal, which had previously been rumored. Andrade is 27 and listed at 6'2", which would give the Sounders more size at center back to help replace the 6'4" Chad Marshall. Their one current starting center back, Javier Arriaga, is 6 feet even. Gomez Andrade is a native of Colombia who has played exclusively in Argentina, starting in the first division the last 2.5 seasons.
Well, just wait till you get a hold of the Portland Timbers.
So if the Sounders do in fact add Gomez Andrade, along with the report we mentioned last week about acquiring João Paulo from Brazil, that would probably finalize their starting roster. Any additional newcomers they would have would probably be more minor in nature.
Nice for them to get size in the backfield, though.
For sure. Assuming this happens. On the CX front, the Pro Bowl happened, one of the many events that was overshadowed by the news of Kobe Bryant's passing. Russell Wilson in that game went 5 of 11 for 78 yards and a touchdown. And Shaquille Griffin had 3 tackles, and box score stats for cornerbacks are not a very revealing thing about what happened in the game, especially in the Pro Bowl.
I watched none of the game while Russ was playing.
I watched none of the game, period.
I watched some of the fourth quarter.
How was it?
They don't really tackle in the Pro Bowl anymore. I don't know if you knew that.
Makes sense.
You wrap up and then they blow the play dead. It was pretty unwatchable, I'd say. The most thrilling part of it, and look, this is an interesting decision by the NFL, is unveiling new rules.
The kickoff? Or the onside kick, I should say.
The onside kick rule. What was the other rule? There was one more new rule.
So instead you had a chance to convert like the fourth down, basically?
It was a fourth and 15 from the 25-yard line.
Okay.
And so if you didn't get it, then this, which I feel like what happened on, Pete Carroll went for this play. They were...
Well, because it doesn't count.
They were down, I think, 4 or 5 or whatever after missing. They were down 5 because they had a two-point conversion that they missed. Kirk Cousins really got sacked a lot for a game that you weren't supposed to be tackling people. Kirk Cousins got sacked a lot.
Let's get Ben Baldwin on whether Pro Bowl rates or sack rates in the Pro Bowl are quarterback function.
I think they were.
Seems like they must be.
He was holding the ball in the pocket a little bit too long. But so they missed that 2-point conversion. There's like 4 minutes left. And then Pete Carroll decides to go for the onside kick from the 25. So the deal is you get a 4th and 15. If you get it, you get the ball wherever it is. If you don't get it, the opposing team gets the ball at the 25. So that's a pretty steep penalty to pay.
What do you, well, like if you get 10 yards, they still get it at the 25 or do they get it at the 35? I think they get it at the 35.
Okay. Well then, I mean, whatever. Like realistically, that doesn't matter that much because you're starting at the 25 and nobody's going to be aiming for 10 yards on a one play from 4th and 15.
Fair.
But it's a steeper penalty to pay than missing an onside kick.
But sometimes you're aiming for the end zone and you end 3 inches short of the end zone on 4th down. What? Is it too soon?
You're talking Jacob Hollister?
Yeah.
He was not 3 inches short. He was a half inch, if anything. And I saw some angles that he was in. But but they went super deep on the play. And the pass was intercepted, which I feel like is an interesting wrinkle. It was intercepted by Earl Thomas, which is an interesting wrinkle because it's like, then do they get it? Like, it's bad to intercept the pass?
Well, I mean, that's the case on any 4th down.
Well, and then they started lateraling the ball after that. The refs just blew the play dead at some point. They were just like, fuck this.
It's the Pro Bowl.
And Pete Carroll was visibly pissed about it. It was pretty funny.
Not converting about them blowing the play dead.
About them blowing the play dead.
Huh.
Because he felt like the play should... Maybe he thought that the NFC was going to intercept one of the laterals. Yeah. Really, they were really pushing these rules. It was kind of funny to see, like, Pete Carroll competes in every situation, no matter how ridiculous it is.
Yeah.
Russ gave up his starting job to Drew Brees. I think maybe assuming that it might be his last Pro Bowl, or thought that was interesting.
Left but, plenty of Pro Bowls ahead for Taysom Hill.
Where do you stand on this onside kick rule?
I mean, they've made it so unlikely to get it now that I think some change needs to be made. And it's also a precursor to just getting rid of the kickoff entirely, which I think the the new XFL is doing correct. They don't have kickoffs at all, do they?
Yeah, I'm an expert in the XFL rules, so it's good that you consulted with me about this.
We need to bring XFL rules expert Ben Baldwin.
He's actually a
XFL consultant.
Yeah.
To
he's all in the XFL broadcasts as the rules expert.
That, I mean, he probably should be. Are you looking this up? Or?
I'm not. I'm looking up the other rule change from the Pro Bowl.
Actually, it's the opposite. That the XFL, they want no touchbacks. They are making kickoffs, but then they're trying to make them safer by not having the same degree of collisions. So,
the Schiano rule. What? Craig Schiano gets a rule?
I suppose he proposed it?
How many years ago is that? I personally am so for this. Like, I want them to enact this onside kick rule next year.
Yeah. I'm good with that.
Oh, so the other rule that they were testing in it was for the eligible receivers, if they flinch at the line of scrimmage but then reset, then it's not a false start.
I mean, I think they should do that for everyone. It's the most ridiculous. Like, if you actually think about it from a logical standpoint, like, okay, we've created a sport. You have to stand there, but you can't move. If you move at all, it's a penalty.
But it's because the moving looks like the play starting. You understand why.
But if the person doesn't...
But then it would become a strategy to be, like, moving backwards.
I mean...
When the ball is snapped.
I just don't think you should have to be set at all. I think, you know... Like, I mean, obviously linemen are set in the CFL, but the fact that you can be in motion in any way at the snap is a dramatic advantage
to
CFL football.
You want to play in the NFC West where people can be in motion at the snap?
Look.
You want Kyle Shanahan and Sean McVay to have that information and Pete Carroll to not have that information?
I mean, he would have the information. He would just not utilize it.
I'm just saying, look, let's just wait until maybe somebody else is the coach of the Seahawks for that to be the case. We should maybe be hoping that they enact a rule where nobody can move pre-snap.
It's harsh, but fair.
But the thing that I care about the most in football is, well, I don't know, this is kind of the craziest thing to say the most, but it's the most fun when you feel like teams are alive and in the game for as long as possible.
Yeah.
Like when you're down by 2 scores and then score a touchdown, you're like, well, it requires an onside kick now. And you're just like, the game's over, realistically. But a 4th and 15, Russ can pick up a 4th and 15.
True.
And you're like, every game that you're down in that situation, two scores at the end of the game, you'll feel like you're in it. I feel like it'll create more thrilling conclusions. And can you imagine Scott Hansen with that situation?
It's low percentage, but it's not impossible. And lately, onside kicks, with the exception of Younghoe Koo, have been impossible.
It is low percentage. And also, like...
Although I hate to lose part of Younghoe Koo's value.
There was discussion about, like, if this was the case, certain teams would do it all the time. But, like, that's obviously not true.
Yeah. And why is that a bad thing?
Well, I mean, that would be pretty awesome.
Yeah. It's great fun.
But also, like, if you don't get it, the punishment of the other team getting the ball to 25 is pretty steep.
Yeah.
So.
It creates higher lever, like, higher swings and win probability. And swings and win probability are kind of fun.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily want them as a fan of your team, but it's just for football in general, yes.
It makes the games exciting for longer, and that's all we should be asking for.
Well, speaking of making the games exciting for longer.
Oh, God.
UW women's basketball, not UW men's basketball, which played overtime twice in LA last weekend, but sadly came up on the losing end both times. 85-80 on Friday at number 10 UCLA, a game they led with 1:30 left and led much of the second half, and then much of the game really after the second quarter, and then an 81-78 loss on Sunday at USC. So Huskies dropped to 2-6 in Pac-12 play despite being competitive in both games, and it gets no easier for them on Friday as number 6 Stanford comes to town. At 7-1, the Cardinal part of a 3-team tie atop the Pac-12 with Oregon and UCLA. Then the Huskies with a better chance to get a win on Sunday when they host Cal, which comes in 0-8 in conference play, including a 67-64 loss in Berkeley to the Huskies in their Pac-12 opener. Since then, Cal has not lost by fewer than 9 points, so definitely the Huskies' best chance for a while here of getting a win in a difficult Pac-12. On the men's basketball front, you have men, another game that they led most of the way and then collapsed late and lost, in this case in a slightly different fashion, at Utah, losing 67-66 on Thursday before suffering their most lopsided loss of Pac-12 play by a 76-62 final on Saturday at number 23, Colorado. So you watched more of this Utah game, I think, than I did, because I only saw the last 2 minutes.
Where were you?
I was at the Blazers game. I was interviewing Luka Doncic and Kristaps Porzingis.
Oh, God. I would trade that for watching this Husky basketball game.
Oh,
it was awful. I watched like the last 9 minutes, and the entire last 9 minutes were awful. Utah doesn't play basketball, and UW doesn't play basketball. Like, they need to end the charge. People trying to take the charge is not playing defense. You're not playing basketball when you're just trying to be perfectly square and then get hit. It's bullshit. And, like, referees in college basketball are not capable enough to determine what is a block foul and what is a charge foul. And, like, it's just random the entire time. So did you see the play where Jaden got called for a tech?
I was watching at that point, but I was also doing other stuff, so I'm not sure I ever actually saw the replay of,
like,
it.
Like, it's a clean block from behind where he hit the ball and then, like, sort of grazed the dude's head, and then the Utah player gets up.
Huh.
Like, looking like, oh my God, sorry. Look, that was just an impression of the Utah player, but just being like, you know, like, dramatically being like, whoa, what happened? It's like, this shouldn't even been a foul.
So, of course, it wasn't. It was a dead ball technical because a foul had already been called. Of course, that required a 5-minute review, as did so many other plays at the end of this game. It's just unwatchable.
The end of this game was just like, it wasn't, this sport was not being played anymore.
Why do we watch college basketball?
I'm done. I swear to God. I did not, you know how many seconds of UW versus Colorado I watched?
I'm guessing it's zero.
Precisely zero. I watched Lakers, Sixers. I think watching Matisse Thybulle in the NBA should count as me paying attention to Husky basketball.
That's fair.
He's playing a real sport in the NBA. He's playing actual fucking defense and not just trying to stand there and have somebody knock him over.
Matisse Thybulle was never doing that in college. Because he was trying to steal the ball.
Playing
every
real basketball. Look, when the game was invented with the peach basket, at no point was like, okay, somebody needs to stand perfectly still and then hope that another person runs into them And that'll be defense.
I mean, a charge shouldn't be something you're trying to do. A charge should be something like that happens.
If you defend and the offense player, I just cut you off.
Yeah, what you're saying. Like, you shouldn't be trying to draw. A foul should never be the goal. This is true on offense as well. Like, this is why James Harden, you know, his game is, and he's not the only one, but his game is so frustrating because his goal is to draw a foul because it's such a high value opportunity.
I do think that's why people just don't connect with James Harden. Like,
oh, for sure. Yeah, it's not fun to watch, even if he's quite good.
I'm not done with this.
Okay.
It is unwatchable. It's not that it's not good. It's that the second, like the last 10 minutes of this game took an hour.
Yeah, I tuned in and I was like, okay, I'll just watch these last 2 minutes and then I'll go grab dinner. And then it kept going and going.
And the Huskies lost. Like, they had the lead.
But Killer Burger was great, for the record.
That's good.
Yeah.
They had the lead and somehow, because of these insane charge rules and just Pac-12 referees, Utah took free throws on. They scored all of their last points were free throws, right?
At least their last 12, yes.
This is not basketball. It's not worth watching. And like the way that Utah plays basketball, and honestly, the way that UW plays basketball some of the time, it's not worth watching. It's just like,
look. I mean, UW is trying. They just are not nearly skilled enough to play basketball.
If they're not going to even bother to play the sport, basketball is a beautiful game. But if you're not playing it the right way, if you're trying to like exploit that Pac-12 referees are bad, it's not worth paying attention to.
Yeah.
So fuck it. I'm done.
Are you ever coming back? I mean, it's wild.
To college basketball?
Yeah.
I'm sure that I will be sucked back in. Like, I know how this goes.
You've watched the Mariners before.
Do I want to watch college basketball ever again? When was the last time I had pure joy watching college basketball?
I can't answer that for you.
2006. It's been 14 years since college basketball. No, I think the one Pac-12 tournament, Isaiah versus Klay Thompson, that was fun.
It was their last 12 points every score for Utah after the final TV timeout was via free throws.
They should maybe even consider getting rid of fouls.
The weird thing is that the Huskies have like theoretically these exciting players. Like Isaiah Stewart is an exciting player. Jaden McDaniels is an exciting player. Naz Carter is maybe the best dunker in the country, and yet they are not exciting to watch play basketball. And that seems like a great failing of college basketball as a sport. So,
I mean, also they have bad guards. Like guards are important.
They are. I mean, they just can't get Isaiah Stewart the ball.
But like, even then, you're like, okay, Isaiah Stewart scoring in the post is not like thrilling to me.
No,
you know, like the Huskies desperately trying to get the ball to Isaiah Stewart in the post. He's a very good post player, and I like Isaiah Stewart in the post, and like he's great. But it's not like none of it is fun. That's the thing. Is all of this takes the fun out of basketball, and what's the fucking point?
I've been told that the NBA ratings are down because they don't have enough post play or mid-range jumpers.
Who said this?
A lot of people on
Wait,
Twitter.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
That's an argument?
Yeah.
Why are the NBA ratings down?
Probably because Steph Curry and Klay Thompson are injured, so the Warriors are really boring to watch. Or, no, they're not actually boring to watch. They're actually kind of fun to watch, but they're not.
People love Marcus.
They're not
Chris.
A draw. And Zion was hurt, and the Pelicans were on national TV a fair bit early in the season. Like, Zion came back, and all of a sudden the TV ratings were great last week. Huh, funny that. It turns
really?
Out that in a star-driven league, for that game, yeah. It turns out that in a star-driven league, when the stars are injured, it's a bad thing.
I do sometimes wonder about Giannis, where it's like, man, thinking about Kobe these last couple of days, it's like Giannis being the best player in the NBA. Like, I like Giannis, but it's just not the same. You know? Like, if you take
I mean, are we talking about the best player in the league?
Who is the best
most
player?
Popular player in the league?
Well, no, he's the best player, but he's not the most popular player.
I mean, he did get a lot of votes for the All-Star game.
But
only LeBron got more.
Players get votes because they're good.
Sure.
And people are accepting, like, okay, Giannis.
I think Giannis is pretty fun to watch.
Is he fun to watch?
Yeah, I think he is.
I don't know. There's something about him that's like not. I think
when he's in the open court,
Luka is fun to watch.
With those long strides?
Maybe it's just like a personality thing where Giannis doesn't have the like cult of personality that somebody like LeBron or Kobe have. But I do wonder, and I think Zion might be able to fill this hole in the post-LeBron NBA, who that person's going to be.
It will be interesting to see.
And also, I think James Harden is just like not a fun player to watch play basketball.
People generally do seem to agree on that.
Let me give you an argument, though, for why the ratings are down. Total randomness.
That's another compelling argument. But you know what every argument that is made for it is?
What?
Whatever personally bothers me about the sport of basketball is why the ratings
are down.
It's because
the Blazers are bad this year. You know, Nurkic was driving those ratings. Everybody knows.
Look, Nurk is fun to watch on the sidelines. He's got crazy sits. That's another.
There was a year that the NFL ratings were down because
2016.
All of the national TV games were bad. Was that 17? And then
16 was when the TV ratings were especially down, and it does seem to have been related to the election to some degree.
Really?
And people were like, "What's wrong with the NFL?" And then the ratings 2 years later were fine. So yes, I don't think
so
you should obsess
it's
over
because
TV
there's
ratings.
An election this year.
Yes, that's. Well, people are too busy watching the Democratic debates to watch NBA basketball.
Oh, this is Klobuchar's fault.
A lot of NBA crossover there.
We knew it was.
So let's talk about Jaden McDaniels, who played decently against Utah, but then after that late dead ball technical came off the bench against Colorado.
Wow.
Mike Hopkins said it was not due to not a punishment for that, but that
he just
hadn't been playing well coming back from the sprained ankle that kept him out against Oregon State a couple weeks ago. And he certainly did not play well at Colorado, going 1 of 6 for 2 points in 9 minutes and did not see action after the 16-minute mark of the second half of this game.
Do you think this has affected his draft stock?
Doesn't seem to.
God, NBA teams are dumb. But maybe we should talk about why ratings are down and that nothing Jaden McDaniels can do seems to affect his draft stock, having no offensive skills whatsoever.
He's got some offensive skills. He's not got offensive decision making. Also, I don't know if you've looked around at the rest of the prospects. Like, I was watching college games on Saturday. I was watching Jaden. I was like, this guy's still in the running to be a top 10 pick, huh? And I was like, I better try to trade my first round pick at the Blazers in the dunked on mock offseason.
Oh my God. Just trade out of this draft completely.
Oh, it's not a good draft.
I pity the Cavs when they end up with Jaden McDaniels.
There's one player. There's two players, I guess, in this entire draft. But one of them I've never seen play, so I don't know.
Oh, wow. That's good news.
Yeah.
You're thinking like an NBA scout, though. Who are the two players that you like in this draft? We have to pay for that information.
I can give you that one. That's Tyrese Haliburton from Iowa State.
Wow.
It's just his name.
Okay.
You can't control what his name is. It's a coincidence.
Really makes you think, doesn't it?
And the other is Devin Vassell from Florida State, who I, again, have never seen play.
His stats are pretty good. So yeah. You would say that ESPN's Kevin Pelton really likes Haliburton. Oh, my God.
Let's talk about the Huskies.
Vassell.
More fun
Vassell
than this conversation.
And Haliburton.
So the amazing thing is that because they keep losing these close games, the Huskies have not fallen at all in KenPom again. They went down last week in only two spots from 44 to 46.
This doesn't mean anything. They don't give trophies for KenPom 46.
It's true. They don't.
Okay. Well, good news that they haven't fallen in KenPom.
This weekend, they host the Arizona schools back home. Arizona fell out of the rankings after a 66-65 loss Saturday at ASU in the Territorial Cup. So those Wildcats also beat the Sun Devils. Since a 9-0 start, Arizona has lost 6 of the last 10 games, but still ranked number 12 overall in KenPom because 5 of those 6 losses have come by 5 points or fewer. The only exception, a 17-point blowout at Oregon State somewhat inexplicably.
They lost to the Sun Devils. Wait. We're the Sun Devils. They're the Wildcats. And the Sun Devils won.
Oh, yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, it's the opposite, isn't it?
Do I have to draw
a
flow chart for you? Okay. It took me a second just to make sure that I heard that right. You were talking about other things. I was thinking about which team won.
Arizona's wins in Pac-12 play have come by an average of 21.7 points per game, giving the Wildcats the best net margin in the Pac-12 with a record tied for 5th in the conference.
Oh, hate the Pac-12.
Freshman key Arizona, including their backcourt of Nico Mannion and Josh Green. Mannion, an NBA lottery prospect, has slowed after a hot start, but is top 50 nationally in assist rate. And then also freshman big man Zeke Nnaji, who is number 4 in the nation in true shooting percentage, making 67% of his twos and 79% of his free throws, is a major threat on the offensive glass. In addition to him, the Huskies will need to find Dylan Smith and Jamarl Baker, both of whom were shooting better than 40% on threes at limited volume.
So what you're telling me is, even though this college basketball season has been bad, at least Sean Miller isn't ranked in the top 25?
Yes.
Okay.
Small consolation. Huskies with a better chance to get a win on Saturday against Arizona State, who before Saturday had basically beaten all the teams they should have beaten and lost all the teams they should have lost to. Their best win before Saturday was against number 71 in KenPom St. John's on a neutral site. Had been 0-4 against Arizona, Colorado, and Oregon, including they played Colorado in China to start the season in what was technically a non-conference game. Their worst loss was to number 53, Virginia, on a neutral site. Everyone else they've lost to is a certain NCAA tournament team.
Virginia's bad?
Yeah, Virginia's bad this year. They can't score at all, defending national champs.
Wow. Like, probably. By KenPom, UW is better than Virginia?
That is correct.
Wow.
Virginia's probably not going to make the tournament.
Wow.
Junior guard Remy Martin has taken over as their leading scorer following the departures of Lou Dort and Zylon Cheatham. Leads the Pac-12 in usage rate with average-ish efficiency. And in the front court, junior Romello White has become a force in the paint, shooting 65% from the field. Look forward to a good battle between him and Isaiah Stewart. Fortunately for the Huskies,
a good battle because it's college basketball.
True. Fortunately for the Huskies, Arizona State really struggles to shoot, making just 31% of their threes this season. So there you go.
I'm sure you'll have really a lot of fun watching those games.
I will not see the Arizona State game. I will be at the Blazers game at the same time, but I will be at the Arizona game to check out those prospects.
Only check out the prospects. Don't look at the Huskies.
The Huskies have, I hate to break it to you, they have some prospects as well. The other thing we should talk about, Raekwon Battle had another big game at Colorado. Hello. You didn't see this, but he was the one who got the start in place of Jaden McDaniels. Raekwon Battle is extremely good when he starts and just does nothing when he comes off the bench.
Let's start free Raekwon Battle.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like he's going to continue to start going forward.
Jaden's going to be benched.
I don't know if Jaden will stay coming off the bench, but Raekwon Battle will definitely continue starting.
What would the starting lineup be then? Is he starting at point guard?
Percy Allen said that Hop had considered benching Hamir Wright, but that Wright had played well at Utah, so that's why he wasn't. So we'll see what happens there. And you won't see what happens then.
I probably will end up watching at least some of these games.
There's just nothing else going on in Seattle sports. The Seattle Dragons don't start for another couple weeks here.
Oh, Dragons! Is The Good Place worth watching?
Yes, of course.
How many episodes have there been after the break?
Just one or two? I think two, but maybe three.
Okay. So I've got to catch up on a couple of episodes of The Good Place.
I've been rewatching season one.
Oh, I've seen seasons one through three so many times.
It's only the second time I've seen it. I started several months ago. I was babysitting your children, and your middle child was home and was watching or was like probably playing on the Switch, and I was just putting something on TV, and I tried to put on Parks and Rec, and he vetoed that. Did not want Parks and Rec up there.
Marco?
Yeah.
He gave a hard veto to Parks and Rec?
Hard veto to Parks and Rec, but he was okay with The Good Place. So I got through a few episodes. You'd have to ask him. Got through a few episodes of The Good Place, and now I'm finishing off the first season.
These are really pretty heady ideas to be exposing my children to.
I think it's good to get them started in some moral philosophy. What we owe to each other. Look, I doubt they're getting it from you.
No, they're not.
Wow.
They're just wondering why we even watch college basketball.
Well, that is something good to teach them.
And learning that you can elbow people every once in a while. I feel like it's Katie who's more likely to teach her child that than me. Luca played, he played a hell of a game, I have to say.
He's like so good at knowing when he gets the ball to run up court.
He's the smoothest basketball player on the team. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so.
And the only NBA comp from him that I can think of is another Luca.
I don't know if I go that far. He's not got the step back three. Luka's finishing could still use some work, but
he's getting there.
The rest of his game is quite strong.
Like, as far as all-around basketball, like, he didn't have any turn. There was one bad shot, and I told him the next day, I was like, you took one bad shot, and he was like, I know. Which one? I was like, hey, that kind of self-reflection is probably not happening for most seven-year-olds.
I don't think so.
So, I didn't even have to tell him, you know what I mean? That's, a good coach doesn't even have to say when they're disappointed.
But you still will. Gotta make sure the kids know that.
Oh my God.
On that note,
I just wanted to say that I felt like the assist that he had, I was like, he had like a solid, like a real assist. 7-year-old basketball, I was like, he's going to get torched by that Storm strength coach. Oh God. Anyway, me and Katie are maybe going to miss that one.
Well, it's too bad because I'm not going to be there either. So team will have to coach itself.
Jan can't go because she's too upset about it.
Reminder, these are 7-year-olds. They don't keep scoring.
Jan is too upset about the game that they don't keep scoring. She won't be in attendance. But anyway.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.